This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, a local historian will share stories about the 1918 flu epidemic and more.
It was nicknamed the crowd disease. They knew it was coming, and then about October, it hit in Santa Barbara, October 1918.
And we'll learn about a San Luis Obispo-based company that's working on what are called right to repair laws.
You know, from a pure free market perspective, just let us fix our stuff is not a super progressive argument, right? This is something that resonates across everyone on the political perspective.
Those stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, July 20th, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. Wildfire season is very much upon us here in California. So far this year, Cal Fire has responded to over 3,900 fires, which have burned over 34,000 acres. Managers of a small preserve in Monterey County are hoping to change the way communities approach wildfires across the state by instead focusing on wildfire management and what's called mimicry. KAZU's Michelle Loxton reports.
The Santa Lucia Preserve is a 20,000-acre private community in Carmel that encompasses much of what the Central Coast is famous for. Oak savannas, redwood forests, and hills that are either green, golden, or multicolored, depending on the season. Those who work on the preserve call it a conservation experiment.
A bold, out-of-the-box approach to living with nature.
That's Dr. Christy Wyckoff, the deputy director of the Santa Lucia Conservancy, the nonprofit that manages much of the land on the preserve. And one of the ways the preserve is trying to experiment with living with nature is with their approach to wildfires. The Conservancy and its partners recently received a number of grants that will go towards their continued efforts to change the way we approach wildfires in California.
I don't worry about the acreage that burns. I worry about the intensity of those fires.
For Wyckoff, it's about coexisting with fire, because she says in California, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. To see these efforts in practice, Wyckoff takes me on a tour. First stop, a grassy ridge that overlooks one of the six creeks in the preserve. The ridge has undergone mastication recently, which is when a huge lawnmower grinds up all the vegetation. Cattle have been grazing on the land, and soon they will have a prescribed burn. These practices are all part of Wyckoff's toolbox of fire mimicry. When put to use, during a wildfire, the land will look like a mosaic.
And what I mean by a mosaic is that it will have different patches where if fire comes in, it will burn at different intensities, and it will provide opportunities for firefighting, but also for the natural world to respond differently. There's species that love fire.
When wildfires burn in this mosaic manner, it means it won't just be toothpick trees left. Instead, some vegetation will survive. Seeds will sprout from the ashes, and birds and mammals will explore what the not-so-severely burned areas have to offer. It also means there will be less risk of mudslides. Stop two on the tour is one of the preserve's forests, which is filled with oak trees, poison ivy, elderberry plants, and much more, growing 15 feet above our heads.
It's got great biodiversity in it, but it hasn't burned in decades. And so there's a lot of fuel buildup in these areas.
Many of these forests line the windy roads in the preserve, and roads are a risk for fire ignition, a spark from a car, or a stray cigarette. Roads are also essential in firefighting, so the preserve created a 15-foot fuel break alongside the road.
By pushing the vegetation back from the edge of the road, we are creating a safe passage.
The break allows residents to evacuate and firefighters to come in. You don't want roads to become impassable. Wyckoff hopes that what they are doing on the preserve can be a model for the rest of California. And actually, some of these tools, like mastication, cattle grazing, roadside fire breaks, and prescribed burning, are already gaining popularity.
Folks at the state level are recognizing prescribed burning as a valuable tool.
That's Davy Rao. She's a livestock and natural resources advisor at the University of California Cooperative Extension. Rao is in on the grants that the Santa Lucia Preserve and partners received. She'll be helping create a Central Coast Prescribed Burn Association, which will focus on teaching others how to do these types of burns.
They will be able to learn how to use a drip torch, learn how to use hand tools, learn how to use a backpack sprayer. And so they're going to get in there and light some fire under the guidance of a very experienced burn boss and several other people.
And so far, there's been massive interest. 180 ranchers, academics, and land management staff signed up for a recent workshop. No matter the tools that are used, for all involved, it's about creating a landscape, or what they call a firescape, that creates manageable fires and not catastrophic ones.
That was Michelle Loxton reporting in Monterey County. Next, correspondent Tom Wilmer visits with a Santa Barbara historian to learn more about what was making news 100 years ago.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from San Ynez Valley. Come along and join us as we visit with Santa Barbara historian Betsy Green. Hi.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
I follow you on Facebook, and every week you're posting something really cool about Santa Barbara history.
Mm-hmm.
So how did that all happen? How did you get interested in that?
Well, I've only been in Santa Barbara about 11 years. Before that, I was living in the Chicago area. Mm-hmm. I really didn't have any interest in history until I moved into an older home. And I got curious about the age of the home, who had lived there. And so I started doing research on the history of the home. I found a picture of the home from 1913, and that's the kind of thing that old homeowners would kill for. And so once my house was done, I started researching other people's houses. And in the Chicago area, I had a business doing it. I researched about 80 homes. I wrote a book for people who wanted to do it themselves called Discovering the History of Your House and Your Neighborhood. Then about 11 years ago, I moved out to the Santa Barbara area.
And what caused that shift in your life?
Oh, I moved here for three main reasons: December, January, and February. And then when I got to Santa Barbara, I wasn't sure what I would write about since I'm kind of the new kid on the block here. But I found a couple of niches that nobody else was covering. I live in a neighborhood called the Mesa, which is an interesting neighborhood. It's sort of a bit of a tableland, hence the name. And it was always called the Mesa, whereas other parts of Santa Barbara, other neighborhoods, didn't have their particular name until maybe, you know, the 1915. So I was able to go back through the newspapers back to the 1850s and look for things about the Mesa, or La Mesa, as it used to be called. So I wrote a column about Mesa history for a number of years and wrote a book called Mesapedia about the history of the Mesa. And then I started getting interested in history in Santa Barbara 100 years ago. I always thought that would be the easiest thing to write about because you're just working with 1 year's worth of material. So back in 2014, I looked at the newspapers for Santa Barbara for 1914. We had two newspapers back then. Luckily, the newspapers published more than the usual stuff. A lot of small papers talk about what the mayor did, who got married, who died, and gee, I think we're going to have a good crop of beans or walnuts this year. But fortunately, in Santa Barbara, there were writers in the papers who were writing about other things. Some of my favorites, and one of the things they did write about, was the Flying A film studio there.
And that predates Hollywood, doesn't it?
In some ways it does, yes. We were one of the biggies back then at that time. Flying A moved to Santa Barbara in 1912, and they had all kinds of adventures as well. Back then, the attitude toward movies was no permits, no problem. They just show up at a bank and have a guy in a mask and a fake gun, and he'd go into the bank, and the tellers would freak out until they saw a guy in the background grinding away at the camera.
Wow.
Another time, they were out on a ranch being cowboys, and a lot of the early silent movies were cowboy movies, and they were, you know, shooting back and forth and running around, and some gardeners who were out there were terrified because they didn't know what the heck was happening.
And were there any Flying A movies that were like nationwide hits?
Back about 1915, the Flying A did have a serial called The Diamond from the Sky, which was one of the early serials. And as you can imagine, we're filming all over the place. And because they were in Santa Barbara, that was also an added incentive for people to go and see the movies. 100 years ago or so, people didn't travel around as much. And so it was really cool to see something filmed in, ooh, Santa Barbara, or ooh, Montecito.
Another dynamic from that time period has to do with the great flu epidemic.
Yes. As I said, I wrote a book about Santa Barbara every year at a time. So I did way back when Santa Barbara in 1918, and then another one in 1919. And at the time, I had no idea that I would be living through something like that. So I certainly am comparing my experiences today to what the people were going through back then. We have a lot more medical knowledge now. The average person back in 1918, 19 really didn't know about viruses. Scientists did, but people knew about germs, but that was it.
But somehow they understood the importance of the mask.
Yes, everybody was wearing a mask, and in fact, because they thought it was germs, some sources said, well, put a couple of drops of kerosene or bichloride of mercury on your mask to kill the germs. Of course, it wasn't good for people to breathe, and everybody at home, I am not recommending this, but they did know that it came from other people. It was nicknamed the crowd disease. They knew it was coming, and then about October, it hit in Santa Barbara, October 1918. You think about it, and we get upset about having to wear a mask now, but back then, the war was still going on, and people were still getting telegrams saying, you know, we regret to inform you that your son was killed. So what a horrible, horrible time. And not only that, everything was closed, like today, the libraries, theaters, the pool halls, things like that. So it must have been pretty boring, but the one bright spot was the local record store, and they had phonograph records back then. The local record store sold records on approval. They would deliver a record in the evening. You could listen to it overnight and ask that they pick it up again the next morning.
Wow.
So people had something different to listen to for the night.
And were there deaths in Santa Barbara?
Yes, there were. It's interesting. It's kind of hard to figure out how many there were, because sometimes the newspapers would just say pneumonia, and so you weren't sure what that was. We were also still under wartime censorship, and everybody, all the papers were trying to keep up our spirits and downplay bad news, and certainly people dying of the flu were bad news. The flu would hit people very quickly. It's different from the COVID deal that we're dealing with now. I remember a story where someone died on Tuesday, and the paper said, and he was fine on Friday night. It also attacked people in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. They were hit the hardest.
Interesting. Yeah, I heard stories of a guy coming home from work on a Wednesday and dead on a Thursday.
It was very sad.
And then it was you or a California history site that was talking about there was a contingent of anti-mask people out there.
We didn't see that in the papers in Santa Barbara. Again, as I said, they were probably focusing on the good news. It was required that if you were going to go on a streetcar, you had to wear a mask. There was one headline that said, "Wear your mask or cops will get you."
Interesting. So let's move on to a brighter subject.
Well, actually, one thing I might want to point out is you asked about deaths. It seemed to be that, like the war, the flu was also downplayed. One of the things going on at that time was eugenics. There was almost a feeling of if you got the flu or you died from it, either you were not living healthily or you were just sort of bad stock.
Inferior breed.
Right. For the first time at this time in the 19-teens, Santa Barbara school kids were getting weighed and measured, and that was totally new.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Correspondent Tom Wilmer is having a conversation with Santa Barbara historian Betsy J. Green.
There's a lot of stories, as I mentioned, about sort of human interest stuff, and a number of them were about animals. One of them was, and this was connected with the flying A, someone had a pet monkey. It got loose one day, and so the monkey went running down the street, and people totally freaked out. Maybe they thought it had rabies or something, but they were calling the cops, they were calling their kids inside and shutting the doors. The cops ran out to catch this animal, and they caught it with a bag of peanuts, and they took him back to the police station, and the monkey was fine with that, and they were playing with the monkey at the police station until the owner showed up.
What year was this?
This was about 1914, 15.
So and, front page news then.
Oh, yes, yes. And the owner showed up, and it turned out the monkey had appeared in one of the Flying A movies. And the owner mentioned that the monkey's name was Caruso. So fortunately, I was able to find old movie magazines online. And this is a great time to be a historian. So I went back to the movie magazines, and I found a picture of the monkey, Caruso, who had been in the movies.
Montecito, for more than 100 years, has been a second escape place, people like you that relocated from the East Coast and Midwest because of the weather. Some top executives. I remember the CEO of Arrow Shirts moved out here.
Well, yes, and it's funny, as I moved out here, I thought, well, everything I knew about Chicago, I'll have to forget about. But if you were a wealthy business owner in Chicago and you could afford it, you came out here for the winter. There's rumors about Charlie Chaplin, and he never filmed out here, as far as I could figure out in all my research. He did visit here. He was a part owner of one of the hotels.
Oh, yeah, the Montecito Inn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they make a big thing about him, but there have been a number of stories saying, no.
Okay, well, moving on, give us another cool subject.
Speaking of Montecito, as I started doing research for the Way Back When books, I started noticing that a number of movie studios were filming on the big estates in Montecito. Because you think about it, if you've seen them, some of them look like ancient Rome or France in the time of Louis XIV or whatever. And apparently the owners of the estates were very amenable to movie companies filming on their property.
So this was beyond Flying A. These were Hollywood-based studios that would come up here to do filming here.
Well, some of them were from Hollywood, some of them were local. I found for my Montecito movie book about 63 movies filmed in Montecito. Mm-hmm. About 20 or so were filmed by the Flying A. But a 40 or so came up from Hollywood or the L.A. area to film on the estates there. And some of the estates are so big, you can see by looking at the movies that they came up one year to the same estate and filmed in one part of the garden, and the next year they came up and they filmed in another part of the garden, and the movie viewers would have no idea they were reusing the same estate, but they had checked it out while they were here. And there were movies filmed in Montecito even before the Flying A got to town.
Oh, wow. So
the
real,
Flying A.
Really,
yes. Right. The Flying A came to Santa Barbara in 1912. But in doing my research for Montecito, I discovered movies that were filmed in Montecito as early as 1910 and 1911. So I went through the old movie magazines and local papers looking for information and photos. It's a lot of tedious research, but one of the things that I do to make it interesting is go through the summaries of the movies and then write about them kind of the way I would describe them to a friend of mine. So here's what I wrote about a 1911 movie. So Valerius is intrigued by a slave girl who is a Christian, which is what The New Faith is all about. The movie's called The New Faith. When she saves his life by pulling a tarantula off his neck, he falls for her and her religion. So he invites her to shack up with him. She admits she loves him, but declines his kind offer of an extramarital relationship, saying, "Over my dead body." Somehow, that makes him love her even more.
Very cool.
Well, another thing that I'm writing about in terms of movies is movies filmed on the Channel Islands. Mm-hmm. There are 8 Channel Islands, and initially I thought there were only about 50 movies filmed out there. But once I started doing some serious research in the old movie magazines, I've discovered more than about 250.
Tell us about how the buffalo got out.
Oh, the buffalo were there for on Santa Catalina Island for an early Western movie. And for some reason, people thought it was cool, and they just left them there. Or else they left and never said why they were leaving the buffalo there, the bison.
But they're still there today,
yes,
right?
Yes, they are.
And when was that movie filmed?
I believe it was in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. Most of the movies that I found, the 260 or so movies, the bulk of them were on Santa Catalina, in part because it was near Hollywood, and in part because it was a large island. There was varied terrain, and you could go out, and it was not very developed compared to the Hollywood area, so you could go out and film a pirate movie and not worry about utility lines in the background or something like that.
Right. And why did Flying A go away? Why did Santa Barbara as a film locale dissipate?
Good question. Whatever happened to Flying A? Well, they were there in Santa Barbara until about 1920-21, making a lot of movies. But one of the problems was they were isolated from Hollywood. But eventually, Hollywood, L.A. area got numerous film companies. So if you were an actor or a technician and you were not on one movie in Hollywood, you could go across the street and get a job with another moving picture company.
Let's zoom forward in time to the 1920s in Santa Barbara. And there was a horrific earthquake that destroyed a lot of buildings and change the architectural future of Santa Barbara.
Yeah, Santa Barbara looks the way it does today thanks to the earthquake and thanks to a group of people who were pushing for a cohesive style before the earthquake. There was a woman named Pearl Chase, a man named Bernard Hoffman, and they had the Plans and Planting Commission, and they were drawing up plans and, you know, trying to get people interested in their plans.
Because before, it was a real hodgepodge.
Yeah, there were adobes, but along State Street, Neil Graffy, one of the Santa Barbara historians, said State Street looked more like Toledo, Ohio than Toledo, Spain. And a lot of those buildings on State Street are from the 1800s. They were wooden, and they just slumped down onto the sidewalk. Fortunately, the big quake was about 6:45 in the morning, so only about a dozen people were killed. But while the city was still in ruins, the Planting Commission said, hey, we've got these plans, let's do it.
So following the earthquake, there's been almost a literal mandate to have this cohesive Spanish Mission Revival style of architecture throughout the core of Santa Barbara, true?
Yes, throughout the core. And if you're on the hillside where you can be seen from the harbor, you have different rules than if you're in a flat area where you can't be seen from a distance. It makes Santa Barbara look like what it does today, and that's why people come to Santa Barbara.
A couple days ago, you posted on Facebook a picture of a lighthouse that crashed down, and it was such a mess, I couldn't even make sense of the photo.
I know, yes. That was from the 1925 earthquake. We had a lighthouse on the Mesa area, which was an elevated area. It had been built in 1856,
wow.
And so it had been there quite a while. Fortunately, no one was injured at the time, but because of the earthquake, the whole tower of the lighthouse just fell right on down. Now, there is a twin of this lighthouse that was built a little earlier in the San Diego area at Point Loma. So there is a lighthouse there that is exactly the same as ours.
So they never rebuilt that lighthouse?
No, our lighthouse was never rebuilt. They just sort of built a beacon tower, which just doesn't have the appeal of a lighthouse. Sorry.
Yeah. All right, Betsy Green, thank you so much for spending the time with me.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's been fun.
That was Santa Barbara historian Betsy J. Green speaking with KCBX correspondent Tom Wilmer. Bakersfield South High School has had a Confederate rebel for its mascot since 1957. Principal Connie Grumling told our colleagues to the east, KVPR, that she is now forming a committee of students, staff, and alumni to consider replacing it. For this audio postcard, KVPR's Alice Daniel reached out to Marcus Hicks, who graduated from South High in 1986. He's now a fashion designer in New York. Hicks talks about, as a black student, what it was like to be in that environment, which included the mascot characters of Jody and Johnny Rebel Yell Leaders. Here's Hicks.
You know, Jody and Johnny Rebel, who were the mascots, would come out, and, you know, Johnny Rebel's the, was the Confederate soldier, and Jody Rebel was like the Scarlett O'Hara type. You know, so the person who came out during the games my senior year was a black woman black young woman in the garb, and Johnny Rebel was Mexican. So it was super weird. And to have school spirit with this display of racism, and it was always a disconnect for me. I always felt disconnected. Students at the time, black students particularly, didn't necessarily overtly see it or feel it as we probably do as adults, because it was so normalized. Like, it was like, oh, this is normal. This is not that big of a deal. But I think it also went with, like, we weren't actually taught anything like substantial about the histrionics of it. Like, it wasn't put in any context. I feel like the educational system itself codified that it was okay in the way that we weren't taught the history from a real perspective. Because had we had classes or teachers or books that really dealt with the subjects, it would have probably made things more difficult. I left Bakersfield and I went to San Francisco State University, and I studied Black Studies. And that was, you know, that was a part of my life where you look back at, you know, growing up and different things that happened while you grew up and then putting it in the historical context, it was like really kind of blew up in my head. Like this was, I didn't notice it as much when it was happening until afterwards, thinking about it, looking at yearbooks and photos, and then kind of coming to grips with that discomfort and also realizing that there was something inherently wrong with kind of being forced into a situation that wasn't good for me as a person, for my development. I just was looking on social media and there was so much pushback to any changes to it, especially like I hadn't realized that they had changed the mascot to where, I don't know the name of the cap, the scrunched down Confederate cap, but they changed it to like a baseball cap. So it's the exact same thing. He's called a rebel. The colors are the same, but they changed that cap to a baseball cap. The face is the same. It's all the same as I remembered. But there was this slight adjustment. And I feel like, I mean, I don't think anyone's coming to terms with the reality of how bad it is or that it could cause so much discomfort or pain to like young men and women going to school. Why not think of a mascot that looks to the future and that gives some hope instead of holding on to this awful, awful piece of history?
Again, that was Marcus Hicks, a 1986 graduate of South High.
The Santa Barbara County Office of Arts and Culture brings new art exhibits to the community throughout the year, like a current sculpture at what locals call Hendry's Beach. Reporting to the KCBX Arts Beat, contributor Beth Thornton speaks with the art office's leader about why she thinks public art is important.
This is Beth Thornton. I'm heading to Arroyo Borough Beach to meet Sarah York Rubin and to see the new sculpture called Camouflage House. It's one of the county's public art exhibits for this summer.
My name is Sarah York Rubin, and I'm the executive director of the Santa Barbara County Office of Arts and Culture.
Responsible for bringing public art to the community. Mm-hmm. Tell us how you decide on what to bring, and secondly, how you decide where to put it.
We are a county government arts agency, a local arts agency, but we are contracted by the city of Santa Barbara as well, and also the state of California, to provide arts and culture services. There's a deliberative component, so there are public art advisory bodies, generally appointed by our elected officials, and art advisory bodies that help determine policy and programming and speak to the community's priorities. And one of the programs that the commission stewards is the Percent for Art, where there's a small fund to create art for the community. And the siting really depends on, there are so many factors, but you know, what is the community interested in or needing? A safe space often, if it's a sculpture, something that you can put in the public right of way and have it engage with kind of the built environment, but also be able to do it where that doesn't present a danger to people, either through edges or through, you know, simple things like making sure that people can detect the bottom with a cane if they need to, or that it doesn't provide a wrong visual cue at a crossing. So there's a lot of kind of extraneous factors that are more logistical and less fun. And then there's the actual placing of any artwork.
The artist, Tom Fruin, has a strong connection to Santa Barbara. He talked about his love of Santa Barbara and his time at UCSB. And I wonder why you chose Arroyo Borough Beach.
We were looking at kind of the campus area. We're looking at sites that could actually, there was a sight line. This one specifically, there's a sight line here to Campus Point. But we were looking at, you know, county properties, but that also had some sort of visual reference to Ivy.
And were there COVID-19 considerations? Having it at a beach seems like a safe place for people to view it from the outside in the fresh air.
This seemed like a very accessible way to do it, where it's a county beach, it's open to the public, it's kind of encouraging people. There's the estuary here, and it's connected. There's a path to the Douglas Preserve. And so just knowing that there's a large block of space. And so our focus has really shifted to outdoor, the production of outdoor artwork right now versus gallery shows.
Give me your thoughts on why public art is so important to communities.
Yes. When you look at why public art is essential and meaningful to communities, there are the facts that it increases civic engagement, that it helps when it's permanent raised property value, that it statistically creates kind of a sense of ownership and pride in a community, that it provides a cohesive visual cue of place, that it reinforces identity, you know, statistics and numbers that, you know, speak to and back up all of those arguments. But it's a visual prompt that, you know, prompts people to think or to reflect, or to commune, or to engage either with the artwork or with each other. I think different types of public art can accomplish that differently.
What's an example of different types of art?
So this is a very meditative piece with the tiny libraries. They were sculptures that held books that people could take, or with the pianos on State Street, you know, there's the invitation for impromptu music making. You know, pertaining to public art in general, I think one of the conversations that's really important in our culture right now, but also in art, is representation and who's being invited to make art, whose stories are being told, whose narratives are being promoted, who's choosing. As a government employee, I appreciate the opportunity to work with the kind of civic advisory bodies, because there's always somewhat of a democratic process, and, you know, the meetings are Brown acted and the committee members are appointed by the elected officials and generally represent different cross sections of people who live here. But I do think as people increase in their awareness and promotion of our communities of color, of our communities whose stories haven't been told, we'll begin to really see some artwork that helps to illuminate some of those experiences and bring those stories to a broader public.
This is a conversation with Sarah York Rubin about Santa Barbara County's public art programs.
I'm sure you plan far ahead for these exhibits. What's next?
Currently, we received a large grant from the state to do a major placemaking project in Santa Maria on the Bettoravia campus at the busiest intersection in Santa Maria, Miller Road and Bettoravia Road. And that will also be with the commission and also supported with some percent for art funding. We're looking at a solar installation. The Bettoravia campus in Santa Maria is transitioning to an entirely solar-powered electricity program. And so looking at artwork that speaks kind of to the solar move to that sustainability, that kind of serves as a beacon for that, but then also is something visual and engaging and ties to, there's a gallery also, a government gallery on that campus, and a large mural, low streetscapers, and then some discrete artworks that have been placed there. So I think also something that ties all of it together to create more of a cohesive experience for visitors.
And when is that anticipated?
The hope is that, you know, it would be installed and finished by this time next year. It's a partnership with Allen Hancock College and with the faculty and students. So both for the ideation and design, the faculty artists, and then hoping that we're able to integrate it into the curriculum and have students create the maps and the signage and just really have a hands-on experience and kind of building out something in their community that they can then go see and reference and kind of, you know, build their portfolios.
There's a virtual map on your website now, right? So you can go to the website and find all of the public art in the county.
Yeah. Most of the public art.
Is there anything else we should know about Camouflage House? Or
it will be on site here at Arroyo Borough for 2 months, and then it will move over to Ealing's for 2 months.
Well, thank you very much, Sarah York Rubin, Executive Director of the County Office of Arts and Culture.
For Issues and Ideas, this is Beth Thornton.
The KCBX Arts Beat is made possible by a grant by the Shanbrom Family Foundation. This is KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. We'll be right back after a short break to check in with the San Luis Obispo County Airport. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Next, we're going to the San Luis Obispo Airport to learn more about a coming project to the airport's runway. Correspondent Tom Wilmer checks in with Airport Director Kevin Booman.
So we are excited to be moving forward on our runway rehabilitation. This project doesn't extend or widen the runway. It simply replaces the surface, and we put in a new airfield lighting system with that. It'll be the same runway, just significantly improved.
But there's some significant enhancements into the bidding process.
Exactly, right? Yeah. Our project delivery method is something we're very excited about in this project. Stepping away from a traditional design, bid, build project, we are going to be doing a construction manager risk contract. And what that means is that there is an initial contract that brings the team together to include both the designer and the builder, and they create the design together to reduce risk in the project. Schedule risk is our primary objective here, given we're a single runway airport. The impact of delays or other challenges on the project would be extremely difficult for the airlines and our customers to adapt to. So we're attempting to design the project in a way that minimizes or potentially even eliminates the need to close the runway for an extended period of time, and then allows us to actually build the project in coordination with that schedule.
Mitigating change orders and cost overruns. This new model mitigates a lot of that.
Yes, that's certainly an objective, as well as cost control. In a traditional project, you always run the risk of unforeseen conditions, schedule delays, design errors, all sorts of things that can drive cost into the project once you're underway. And under this type of contract, there's a guaranteed maximum price, which really reduces or even eliminates that risk in most cases. And so we're excited about that potential as well. And it's the first time this airport has engaged this type of contracting. It's been used in other airports throughout the country, but it's still a relatively new method to deliver projects with.
And again, the reason for the project is not to lengthen the runway, but to structurally enhance it, correct?
We'll still have the same bearing capacities mm-hmm. that it does today, so it doesn't allow us to do anything we aren't doing today. This is not considered an airport expansion project. It's an airport maintenance project, but it's a heavy level of maintenance because we're having to replace the surface and sections of the runway that have deteriorated over the years. The work will be done next summer, so we're early in the phasing of it now, but there's a lot of work to do to get ready for construction next year.
And once again, to reiterate, An additional benefit is mitigating the potential for time overruns and having the runway down for a longer period of time.
Absolutely. As a single runway airport, we don't have any other place to move the traffic to, so being able to have a construction schedule that the airlines understand well in advance and can make any adjustments to flight schedules with, you know, which happens 6 to 9 months prior to the project being initiated. Once we forecast that schedule, we need to be able to perform to that schedule.
Do you have to shut the runway down while you're doing the work?
That is still being looked at. There will likely be periods of complete closure overnight. And so the question remaining is, will there need to be multi-day closures where we have to work through the day for certain aspects of the project? Or could we actually design this in a way that we have no sustained closure and we do it all with overnight closures? So that's all just starting to be looked at right now, but we're very excited about what this collaboration will bring to the project.
Kevin Booman, thanks.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from San Luis Obispo County Airport, where we've been visiting with Airport Director Kevin Booman.
Next, the U.S. Forest Service plans to prevent wildfires in the Los Padres National Forest by cutting down trees and chaparral across a 755-acre area. The Central Coast's congressmen and local environmental groups say the project is unchecked and unnecessary. Sean Flannelly reports.
The project area is located on a ridge leading up to Ray's Peak, popularly known as Pine Mountain. Forest Service managers are expediting the project using what's known as a categorical exclusion. That bypasses an environmental impact review because they do not see the project having environmental effects.
It's a project that we don't think is entirely necessary, and they are using this, this sort of fast-tracking to push it through the environmental review process as quickly as possible.
That's Bryant Baker, Conservation Director for Los Padres Forest Watch. The group is concerned about an ongoing trend of the Forest Service using categorical exclusions to speed up projects. In 2018, President Trump issued an executive order directing federal agencies to streamline projects by using categorical exclusions wherever possible. A 2019 memo from the National Forest Service to regional directors echoes this directive. Gregory Thompson is in charge of the Ray's Peak plan for Los Padres National Forest.
Categorical exemptions don't mean that you don't look at and analyze the area. What it means is that you have a certain type of activity that's been looked at quite a bit, and in the past, those type of activities have demonstrated that there's no extraordinary circumstances that would lead to a significant environmental impact.
Forest Watch's Baker says the environmental analysis that comes with a categorical exclusion is not enough. He also points to a fuel break assessment the Forest Service released, ranking the maintenance priority for different regions of the Los Padres Forest. Ray's Peak is ranked 118 on that list, which Baker says brings into question the need for fast-tracking the project. Richard Halsey, from the California Chaparral Institute, argues the plan would harm the very habitat it aims to protect, and may actually cause flammable weeds to grow in the damaged soil. In addition to the environmental groups, local Chumash tribes are concerned about the environmental impact of the project and the lack of tribal input in the process. Mara Sullivan is a member of the coastal band of the Chumash Nation. She says state-recognized tribes like hers don't get the same rights or recognition as federally recognized tribes.
Not having federal recognition puts us at a disadvantage for certain things. And so this is one of those things.
Sullivan says tribal members are trying to figure out their rights with regard to this project, and that the Forest Service has done the bare minimum in terms of local outreach. The Forest Service recently extended the public comment period for the project after a request to do so by Central Coast Congressman Salud Carbajal. The public now has until August 14th to voice opinions on the Forest Service's Ray's Peak plan. Reporting for KCBX News, I'm Sean Flannelly.
For our final segment today, Working Lunch is a weekly Facebook Live conversation between the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce and someone in the community doing interesting or innovative work. Today, we'll hear from a local tech business leader who believes, quote, it's high time we demand the right to open, tinker with, and repair everything we own.
I'm Jim D'Antona, President and CEO of the SLO Chamber, and today I'll be having a conversation with repair advocate, business leader and grammar champion, the co-founder and CEO of iFixit, Kyle Weens. For those of you who aren't familiar, iFixit is an online repair community and parts retailer internationally renowned for its open source repair manuals and product teardowns. iFixit helps consumers reduce electronic waste by teaching people to repair their own gear. Kyle is a thought leader in the repair space, regularly featured in the likes of Inc. magazine, The Atlantic, Vice, and others as a voice for repair and advocate for policies that empower customers to fix things they already own. On top of all this, Kyle is also the chief software architect at Dazuki, a software company that emerged from iFixit to create easy-to-use, standardized working instructions and procedures. Let me just say, if you haven't heard of or met Kyle before, he's world famous. He travels the world talking to people about the right to repair. I'm so looking forward to talking with Kyle about the work he's doing to collect and make public medical device manuals, his thoughts on the role of business in COVID, his recent advocacy. Thank you so much for being here, Kyle. Pleasure to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me. And I'm not traveling the world anymore. I'm right here at home.
Well, you know, right off the bat, kind of to that point, you know, Slo County may soon be on the state's watch list due to the rise in local cases. Yeah. And we were talking a little earlier, you had some pretty strong feelings on the role of business in helping to limit the spread and the connecting between public and economic health. Share a little bit about what you thought about that.
Well, we have been really proactive from the beginning. We went to work from home well before the state or the county suggested it. And so protecting our team is first and foremost. And I don't want anyone on my team. It hasn't happened yet, knock on wood, and I'm going to continue the fight to keep our people healthy. And so to protect our people, we need to take all of the measures that we can internally with sanitization and distancing and minimizing the number of people that are in the office. But we also need society to step up and do their part, right? This is a transmitted disease. And so as we see the spike in cases, I start to get worried about our ability to operate, right? If you need to go to the grocery store and half the people at the store are infected, that's a risk, right? We're not anywhere close to that now, but we could get there, and the trajectory is not promising. So I think that it's incumbent on all of us, as frustrating as it is. I saw a wonderful video of a four-year-old yesterday who was so devastated that the ice cream truck was shut down. And she has a very legitimate gripe, right? This is frustrating. It's frustrating for her. It's even more frustrating for the owner of the ice cream truck and their family, right? But we have to find a way to sacrifice together to get to a point where we can beat this thing. And I've been really encouraged. I've seen a lot more masks the last week than I did previously. We need to stop politicizing this. We all just need to buckle down and do what we need to do. Do what they told us in the first place, right? Wear a mask, wash your hands, all the basics. And we'll get through this. In the meantime, we're doing everything that we can to protect our team. Our shipping operations, we have split shifts, which is not fun for anybody, but it means that we have two groups of people that don't interact with each other. In case some of our critical people get sick, it doesn't take out the other group. And that's a, you know, operational inefficiency. It's frustrating for people with families because they have to work on weekends where they didn't previously. But that's the extent that we have to go through to maintain business continuity.
Business owners get it, and we just need everybody that, even if it's not your business, follow along on those pieces. So what it's been like to navigate the kind of COVID-related challenges, how's iFixit dealt with that?
Well, there's been a handful of things. One is just what the macro trends are, right? We enable people to maintain and repair their things. And so when, like, the Apple stores are closed and you cannot take your phone into the Apple store to repair it, well, we're the logical backup option. So, you know, our, the traffic to iFixit in terms of people looking for repair solutions, and then our sales have been up. We've been very busy, and it's been a challenge. Like, how do we scale? How do we scale our supply chain? How do we scale our team while we're distancing and we're separated? At the same time, we've also said, how can we help the broader situation, right? Hospitals are under load like they've never seen. We're you know, finding ventilators in every corner of the earth that we possibly can, refurbing them, putting them back into operation. And so right at the beginning, I said to our team, I said, we got to find a way that we can be part of the solution of this. I'm not just going to be standing on the sidelines waiting for the medical professionals and the scientists to solve this for us. What can we do to help? And the answer came from some of the advocates that we've been working on with Right to Repair, where they said, hey, you know, the hospitals don't necessarily have access to all the information that they need. The service information has been kept away from hospitals increasingly as manufacturers have sought to, they want to take repair services and make that a service that's provided by the manufacturer and take it away from the hospitals. And maybe that works in the best of times, but when you've got hospitals locked down and they're not allowing service technicians to travel, hospitals are on their own. They have to do the work themselves. And so we launched a crash project to set up a medical service manual database. And that's what we've been working on basically since the pandemic started.
So how did you find it and how did you get all this uploaded?
We like to say that all of the information in order to fix everything out there is out there in the world. It's just not evenly distributed. And so some hospitals had the information. The professionals who do the repairs in the hospitals are biomedical technicians or biomeds. They're kind of the unsung heroes of the hospitals. They live in the basement and they emerge to sort of, you know, grab the equipment that doesn't work. They take it down to the basement, they fix it, they put it back. They're amazing people and they're problem solvers. And so they have this sort of underground network of service manuals where every time they meet another biomed, they swap USB drives and swap service manuals. So we said, well, can we sort of take that from SneakerNet to make it online and put a professional modern database on top of it?
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. The Slow Chamber's Jim D'Antona is having a conversation with Kyle Weens, co-founder of iFixit.
How do you think your engineering background kind of shaped your approach to policy?
Yeah, well, so our mission is to teach people how to fix things. And we kept running into these obstacles where we knew how to fix it, but we couldn't enable people to repair it because they didn't have the tool. An example is with your iPhone, if you have the home button on an iPhone, it's easy to swap out the home button if it breaks. There's a special software tool that we have to have that tells the phone, this is new home button, work. And we don't have that software tool. And so it's impossible for anyone but Apple to perform that repair on an iPhone. And so we realized that we needed to work on legislation, that the like next step to getting people to fix things. We tried asking Apple nicely. We tried working through all kinds of business forums to have a conversation with them, and they refused. They institutionally did not want to share the information. So we said, okay, you know, this is time for society to make a decision. And there's precedent for this. We have existing laws for cars that Ford and Honda are required to share service information with local mechanics here in San Luis Obispo about how to fix their cars. If we did not have those right to repair laws for cars, then you would not have an option outside of going to the dealership. And so that is something that society decided. We said, we're going to pass laws. We're going to make sure that auto repairs is a competitive field and not a monopolized field by the manufacturers. So I just looked at this as a problem to solve, just like any other engineering problem of, you know, we need access to this information. The companies will not provide it willingly. And so society is going to have to step up and do it. And then we just started wading in and saying, how can we do this? And I started getting involved in the public policy sphere around 2011, when it became illegal in the US to unlock a cell phone and move it from, say, AT&T to Verizon. So you'd have a perfectly functional cell phone. You'd say, I want to move it to Verizon when I switch carriers, and it was illegal to do it. And so I helped put a coalition of folks together to change that. And it took us a couple years, but we got a law passed and Obama signed it, and it is now legal and actually required for the cell phone manufacturers or the cell phone telecoms to share the unlock code so that you can move your phone, which not only is beneficial to you if you want to move your phone from one carrier to another, but also if you're done with your phone and you want to sell it, it increases the resale value of the phone because there's a larger market available for it. We realized that there was no advocacy organization representing repair shops, and so we helped set one up. Repair.org is the repair association that represents repairers, whether they're iPhone repairers or medical device repairers. That together we have more of a voice than we do individually. And so setting up a trade association was a big part of that.
I think you found possibly the only issue that environmental advocates and libertarians can agree on. Were there any other unexpected like bedfellows who show up?
Yeah, we've got small business in rural areas. We've got farmers on board with environmentalists working on the same issue. And they don't normally get along. How I like to describe right to repair is it's about humans versus corporations. That all humans are on board with the idea that we should be able to fix things. And it's really only a very few corporations that are opposed. It's really just the manufacturers, these very large scale monopolistic manufacturers. And it's crazy. Some of them, like Medtronic, one of the biggest medical device manufacturers in the world. They started as a repair organization. They started as an independent repair shop fixing medical equipment. And then over time, they got to the point where they were making their own equipment and everything else. Well, now they're doing everything they can to put these independent medical repair organizations out of business. And that's why we got the libertarians on board. Reason Magazine did a big feature on Right to Repair. And they're like, look, we want a capitalistic, open, free market for repair services. And what has actually happened is there are overreaching copyright and intellectual property laws that have created this sort of protectionist system that has enabled Medtronic to monopolize the system. We could roll back those copyright laws, or we can introduce other counteracting laws. But from a pure free market perspective, just let us fix our stuff is not a super progressive argument, right? This is something that resonates across everyone on the political spectrum. California's Right to Repair bill has been introduced in the legislature the last couple of years. It was introduced by Susan Talamantes-Eggman, who's a fairly progressive legislator from Stockton. But Jordan Cunningham was also, co-sponsoring it and helping push it along. And we're hopeful that we will get it through. Our state level legislation got derailed by COVID, but we're hoping that it will come back with a vengeance next year.
For people who want to be more thoughtful consumers, what are your kind of top three recommendations for repair products?
Oh, I have so many recommendations. You can give me a category and I will recommend things. The first thing is, whatever you're buying, look at the older version of it and see if you can get replacement parts. So if you're thinking about a new pair of Bluetooth headphones, if you're looking at a vacuum or a refrigerator or whatever it is, look and see. It doesn't necessarily have to be that model, but a couple models back, if you go to the manufacturer's website, do they have a path for you to get replacement parts? In power tools, if you're going to buy a drill from Makita or DeWalt, the answer is yes. Overwhelmingly, all the major large manufacturers you can get parts for. With some other things like vacuums, not necessarily. So do some research. So that's tip number one, is look to see if you can get spare parts. Tip number two, friends don't let friends buy AirPods. The problem with them is that there is no way to replace the battery. And so after about 18 months, your batteries start to degrade. And after 2 years, 2.5 years, they are non-functional. But the other thing is, they cause fires in trash facilities. So if you throw it in the trash, goes to the trash compactor, it compacts the batteries in them, and they blow up. And we have had, I was just talking with the local waste management facility, and they have a couple of trash truck fires a year that are caused by batteries. You also cannot recycle AirPods. So buy all the AirPods you want, but never throw them away and never recycle them. My primary recommendation is stick with the wires, but if you got to go wireless, pick one that has a replaceable battery.
Thank you, sir.
That was Kyle Weens, co-founder of iFixit, speaking with Jim D'Antona from the San Luis Obispo Chamber's Working Lunch. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. That's at kcbx.org.